Welcome to the podcast of Greenlight Bookstore. This is the quarantine season. While Greenlight isn't currently hosting in-person gatherings, we're still striving for ways to create connection around books. Thanks to the gracious efforts of authors and interviewers scattered across the country and the world, we've taken our events programming online, hosting live readings, conversations, and audience questions via Zoom. Our podcasts this season are a record of those intimate conversations between thinkers and creators speaking from separate rooms, and a window into the ways that ideas and stories connect us all. Once you've listened to the conversation, you can purchase the books mentioned in this podcast at Greenlight's two bookstore locations in Brooklyn or on our website at greenlightbookstore.com.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's live online author event with Greenlight Bookstore. I'm Katie from Greenlight, and we're thrilled to host tonight's event with Gabrielle Korn presenting her new book, Everybody Else is Perfect, How I Survived Hypocrisy, Beauty, Clicks, and Likes. She will be talking with Wembley Sewell, so you're in for an excellent time. Before we start, I just want to say a huge thanks to Gabrielle, Wembley, and the team at Atria Books for making this happen, and to all of you for showing up. Though we're not able to host events in our store spaces, our community of authors and readers is still here. We're grateful for your support and for the chance to make space for conversation and connection. We are recording tonight's event, so look for video or audio versions on our social media channels later on. And importantly, tonight's featured book, Everybody Else is Perfect, is available for sale from Greenlight Bookstore. You can shop in person in our bookstore locations from 12 p.m. to 7 p.m. every day of the week, and you can purchase Gabrielle's book and many others on site. Or you can order online at greenlightbookstore.com for a quick pickup at the store or for shipping anywhere in the U.S. If you care about supporting the careers of authors and the ongoing existence of independent bookstores, buying tonight's featured book is a great way to show your support. Our interviewer for tonight is Wembley Sewell. She is the editor-in-chief of Them, a next-generation community platform for and by the LGBTQ+ community. The youngest ever to helm a Condé Nast title, she is fiercely dedicated to amplifying inspiring, emerging queer voices and storytellers. Sewell formerly oversaw social growth and digital innovation at publications like Teen Vogue, Refinery 29, and 17 Magazine. She will be speaking with our featured author, Gabrielle Korn. Gabrielle is a journalist, digital media expert, and the former editor-in-chief of Nylon Media, an international lifestyle publication focused on emerging culture. Under her editorial leadership, Nylon became a fully digital brand with an ever-growing audience and original, politically driven, thought-provoking beauty, fashion, music, and entertainment content. She spent 3 years working on Nylon's digital presence before her promotion to editor-in-chief, working across platforms and growing traffic. Prior to that, she was an editor at Refinery 29, overseeing beauty content during a period of explosive traffic growth and working to expand the brand's concept of what beauty means to the millennial reader. She graduated from NYU's Gallatin School of Individualized Study in 2011 with a concentration in feminist queer theory and writing. She lives in Brooklyn. Her new book, Everybody Else is Perfect, is a provocative and intimate collection of personal and cultural essays featuring eye-opening explorations of hot-button topics for modern women. The book has received praise from many fellow writers, including Moira Donegan, Tegan Quinn, Phil Picardi, and Kristen Iverson, who says, filled with insight, wisdom, wit, and a clingy Scorpio X, Gabrielle Korn's Everybody Else is Perfect is a bracingly candid look into what it's like to navigate the often ugly realities of women's media. Korn is fearless in her exploration of her professional and personal life and has written a queer feminist Bible for all the millennials who haven't yet figured out that we are enough just the way we are. Gabrielle is going to start us off with a reading from the book, and then she'll be talking with Wembley and with all of you. Please take it away, Gabrielle.
Thank you so much, and thank you, Greenlight, for having us, and thank you, everyone, for coming. I'm going to read an abridged version of the beginning of chapter 2, which is called Staying Out. I'd felt an attraction to other girls for as long as I could remember, but up until I was a teenager, I thought that everyone did. At 15, I made out with my best friend on a dare, and she pulled away with a perfunctory, ew, wiping her mouth, and it felt like my heart was being run over by a Mack truck. She was definitely the coolest person in the entire world, and she'd picked me to be her best friend. She was punk before anyone else we knew, dyeing her curly black hair every color of the rainbow, arranging safety pins and aggressively political patches throughout all of her belongings. We had sleepovers almost every weekend. We'd get intentionally stuck in thunderstorms in the mall parking lot and then spend hours aimlessly walking through the aisles of Tower Records, documenting every moment on disposable cameras, however mundane, because everything, to me, felt like magic. I had always flirted and been affectionate, not just with her, but with all my friends, and they'd started to give me suspicious looks if I took it too far. At crew practice, a popular girl whispered in my ear that she wanted to hook up with me, and I was so convinced it was a trap that it made me cry. someone I'd been friends with started an email chain saying that I acted like I wanted to have a dick. I remember that I kept thinking on repeat, what the fuck is wrong with me? After that, I always had boys around, most of whom I think I did like, but I would become repulsed by them as soon as they actually became my boyfriend, which made my peers think I was kind of slutty, a safe, convenient reputation considering what was really going on with me. If they thought I was a slut, they wouldn't think I was something else. The public school I went to was wildly homophobic. Maybe it was a reflection of the times, but the few out gay kids, and the closeted ones for that matter, were mercilessly bullied. I'd find out years later that a group of kids a few grades above me had a running bet about whether or not I was gay, which was undoubtedly the worst thing you could be, aside from unattractive. There was no such thing as learning about queer people and their contributions to society in a curriculum, so it's no wonder that the word lesbian didn't fully materialize for me, mostly because there were no other lesbians around me to look up to, in real life or in the media I consumed. I was well aware that I had major, intensely physical crushes on girls, but I felt totally separate from who I was. A subtext that I didn't realize informed the plot. I thought maybe I was just bad at sex. Everyone else seemed to really like it. At the end of my freshman year of NYU, I decided to stay in the city for the summer. I was acting like a feral cat. Going home to Long Island after two semesters of total freedom was unimaginable. Plus, I was busy. I'd gotten an internship at an indie record label in Williamsburg and a night gig working the door at a music venue in Alphabet City. The internship, like most, was unpaid. But at night, the aging, mullet-haired venue manager was often so coked out that he'd just toss several stacks of 20s at me, laughing and saying, "How much am I supposed to pay you? Whatever, here." I'd get home at 3 a.m. and show up puffy and greasy to the office at 9 the next morning, where my intern supervisor, who had hooked me up with the venue gig, would tease, "You're the hardest working teenager in the music industry." I moved to the summer dorms a few blocks east into a suite with 3 bedrooms and 6 girls total. My new roommate was a psychology major who blushed when she laughed, named Lucy. She had short, wheat blonde hair, huge, doleful pale blue eyes, and an oversized labret piercing. She was, frankly, the first out lesbian I'd ever gotten to know. After a few days of intense manic friendship, during which we ate dumplings and watched Buffy on my laptop, I nervously told her I thought maybe I was bi. Lucy replied with an eye roll and a sigh. She said, "Straight girls always say that to lesbians," shutting down the conversation before it even started. But sometimes I'd catch her smiling at me across our small kitchen table while we smoked pot out of a hookah and ate takeout with our other roommates, everyone in tank tops and cutoff shorts, barefoot and high and sweating, the air thick with our teenage summer smells. One night, a couple of weeks after I'd moved in, she texted me to come meet her at a nearby party because she was too drunk to walk home alone. I picked her up around 2 a.m. after work, and we held hands on the way back to the dorm. I was wearing a short black dress, combat boots, and oversized black plastic glasses with no lenses. It was drizzling lightly. When we got back, I turned the lights out and we got into our separate beds. A few minutes later, she wordlessly got into mine. My heart was pounding so hard I thought maybe she could hear it. I wasn't sure if she was just making an alcohol-induced decision, and I certainly didn't want to cross any boundaries, so I lay as still as possible. Eventually, she kissed me. Time slowed down and then it sped up. Within a matter of days, I was telling everyone I knew that I had a girlfriend. It all happened so quickly, the previous 2 semesters of drunken hookups immediately fading into the background, with my new gay life and all of its possibilities shimmering around me. I had just turned 19 and for the first time was catching a glimpse of what it might feel like to live on my own terms. My friend Gabby was one of the first people I told. I called her from a bench in Washington Square Park on a warm afternoon toward the end of May, and I remember her saying, "I'm so jealous. I want to like a girl too." I knew it wasn't just about liking one girl, though. There was an ancient yearning just waiting to break free. I think that if I had met a woman I was attracted to who liked me back any sooner, I would have come out then. It was really just a matter of my feelings being validated by someone else. I immediately cut off all my hair.
So that was the excerpt. Hello, everyone. If this was like a full house, like where we all were together, I would break out into applause. I have to say, from all of the media memoirs I have read, that is the queerest chapter I have ever heard. So like, I obviously was over the moon reading it. But I wanted to start by saying congratulations on the launch. You know, again, round of applause. It's an amazing, amazing book. And I can't wait to dig in this time we have together.
Thank you. I'm so happy that you're doing this.
Oh, likewise. I was saying off screen that I like keep blushing because it's just, you know, it's amazing to have this kind of forum. And it's rare, you know, I think to be able to kind of hold space and hold community with, you know, other queer women in media. So I have such reverence for this moment. And thank you to everyone who has joined us. So without further ado, let's get started. So it's clear, I mean, from that, what you just read, and, you know, from diving into all of the chapters and from just knowing, you know, everything that you have done throughout your career, it's immediately clear, you know, you are a multi-hyphenate person. And you also have a very, very, very layered story. And so kind of a typical question, but I think one that's necessary is I think a lot of people want to know what that process is like when you have so much to share. What is that process of reflection like when you're looking to pick what you want to include in such an amazing book like this?
Totally. And that's a good question. And, you know, the process was not, it wasn't linear, because I had set out to write a book that was cultural criticism. And it was in creating the book proposal for it and then working with my editor on it in the beginning that I realized that I couldn't really make a compelling argument that would matter without talking about myself. So I didn't really set out to write a memoir. And because of that, it was never a book that was like, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. It was more like, here are 10 ideas I have about media, about the way women experience the world. And here are my experiences that ladder into it. And then it was a matter of like, okay, what am I comfortable with people reading? What is relevant to the story? What can I talk about thoughtfully without hurting other people? What details are fun, what details are just gratuitous, and trying to just really have like empathy for the future version of me that will have to live with these decisions forever.
For sure. And I think, I mean, media memoirs are not a new thing. You know, collected essays about media, they're not a new thing. They're always, yes, you know, informative and, you know, reflective. But I think something that makes yours really, really special and feel really, really intimate and real and raw is that you chose a path of like true, like radical honesty. You know, there was, like I said, kind of no holding back. And at what point, you know, in the process of putting this all together, did you just decide to go for it?
Very early on, because I think, to your point, there are so many media memoirs, and I didn't want to write like a workbook. Like, I wanted work to be really central, because work has been pretty central to me, but I wanted it to be more than that. And I feel like writing gets so boring when someone's not being emotionally honest. And like the last thing I ever wanted to do was write a boring book. Mm-hmm. So it
definitely
was
not that.
Thank you. It kind of never occurred to me to like not do the radical honesty thing. What was hard was like paring it back after I had done that, because my process was basically writing it all out. And I had a lot of the writing done already, because I process trauma through writing about it. So I had like a million different Google Docs and notes apps going. And had to put it all together. And it was like, it was so raw that I think the first few drafts were definitely, it was too real. And I think it was important for me to figure out where the boundary was going to be between the self that I share in this book and the self, you know, that I live with every day. Because I just don't think it would be a good experience for me to like have all of my secrets in a book that's really like, I need to keep some things for myself.
That would be a diary and or a Twitter feed.
Right.
On the person.
Yeah. It's not a live journal.
But I have to say, I know obviously the book makes it clear you began as a writer, you found your passion as a writer, but you know, namely you're the editor in chief of Nylon, youngest to ever hold that title. And part of the role of an editor, you know, I can attest, is to try and make stories as strong as possible. What did it feel like to go back though, you know, to writing and writing such raw stuff, while still having that, you know, excellent top of your game editor brain?
I will say it cured me of the desire to ever criticize anyone else's art again.
Done.
Yeah. Like I feel like I developed a newfound empathy and sympathy for people who make things that are then dissected publicly, because it's like you put your whole heart and soul into it. And then it's literally people's jobs to decide whether or not it's good. And being on the other side of that has been pretty scary, but also like pretty humbling. And it's nice to be making the thing instead of writing about the thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's very much so, you know, when you're in that, you would be at this point, you know, writing about your book right now.
Right. Exactly.
But again, I do want to shout out before we get any deeper, I do want to call out to the Q&A because I know plenty of people have tons of questions. We're going to keep talking and gabbing, but I don't want to take up, you know, all the time. So just going to shout out that Q&A feature before we get into what is going to be my favorite probably topic of discussion. I don't know if it's kosher to be talking about bias, but I'm really, really preferential to everything that has to deal with like queerness in your book, obviously. So the chapter staying out was that everyone got to hear, you know, a snippet of was my absolute favorite. Because I think you talk about the intricacies and nuances of, you know, your journey in a really beautiful, beautiful way. And I know we talked about, you know, your process of peeling back all the layers and deciding what you wanted to keep in, but, you know, talking about your own process and your own self-discovery and how you find language is such a different thing, you know, as you well know. And I was wondering if you could speak to that a little bit, what that was like and what it felt like.
Yeah, I think that as queer people, we all have a tendency to want to rewrite our own histories because like there's the life you live and then you come out and then you have all of these memories and you have a new lens for them. And like, unless you have always had clarity around your queerness, I think it's so tempting to look back on everything and be like, well, like I did this and this and this because I knew I was gay. And like, the reality is I had a lot of boyfriends in high school and like some of them sucked and were terrible people, but the majority of them were very, very sweet boys who were very confused when I broke up with them out of nowhere after 2 weeks. And I really had no insight into why I was doing that. It was just like this messy thing that I always did until it was my reputation. And like in hindsight, I know exactly what that was about, but at the time I didn't. And so I wanted to tell that story honestly, because I think that like the queer teen who could read that and see herself in it, like her feeling validated by my honesty was more important to me than like rewriting the things that happened in a way that would be flattering to me. So I wanted to do that. And then I also wanted to, the chapter is called Staying Out because it's like, it's only a few pages about coming out. And the rest of it is about having to come out again and again and again every day for the rest of my life. Because like, when you look like this, people don't see a lesbian, they see whatever they want to see. And in work situations, like that can be really rewarding or mostly like really awkward. And it's like, and then you get to a place where everyone you work with knows you're gay. It's not a big deal. They support you. And then you're taken out of that environment and like at work events with strangers, on press trips with strangers. And it's like, it just becomes this constant negotiation of like, will these people still be nice to me if they know I'm gay? I know nothing about them. So I wanted to really like harp on the fact that like coming out is not just like one thing you do once. It is, it's an ongoing conversation with yourself and with the world, because we live in a world where people have not just heterosexual bias, but heterosexual assumption. And you're up against that every single day forever.
Yeah. And I think, you know, your relationship naturally to coming out and how you come out, if you choose to even come out, also changes throughout various stages of your life. If you even realize, you know, I think sometimes people do and they don't even, I think about myself, like I went to an all girls high school, like boarding school. So like people are doing it in small ways without even realizing it, which is a whole other thing. Maybe I'll save it for if I ever write a book, but
I can't wait.
This is all about you. And to that point though, I do want to talk about, you know, really formative experiences for a moment. I know some people shy away from like talking about college. Firstly, I think your college experience sounds sick, amazing. I haven't been sick in years, but it just, you know, working in music and meeting all these people and creating what was a very specific, tailored, you know, major that I think proved really foundational, you know, to you. So I think my question is, you know, what about your college experience from learning about theory to really getting to hone your craft as a writer helped shape you into the path you took professionally?
I mean, I'm so consistent in that, like, I feel like my major is, which was queer and feminist theory and writing. Like, I mean, that's just like what I did with my life. I've really stuck to that. And I think the thing about critical theory is like beyond the, like, you know, the history that's involved in it, it really teaches you how to think and how to question and how to understand that there are systems at play in the world that intersect and that keep certain kinds of people down. And I think it really like radicalized me in a lot of ways. Yeah. And I brought that with me when I went into like the beauty industry. Yeah. And I think having that foundational education set me apart, especially because like I wasn't someone who, I didn't study like magazine journalism. I mean, I studied journalism for sure, but I wasn't like reading about the glossies. I wasn't like, I wasn't following beauty bloggers. Like, I feel like I really knew nothing. And in my first job interview at Refinery, I was like, I don't know anything about beauty, but I love Sephora and I love to write. Mm. And I can't believe I got the job after saying that. But what I had was this like automatic suspicion of the industry. And like my instinct was to always just question why we were doing things the way we were doing. And I think that set me apart and served me in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, I also was a queer studies minor. And I think even by nature of that minor, it's so different than when you studied it, when I studied it, and it's changing every single day. I think we have a piece on them that it's like, what purpose does that really serve when it's so, so fluid and what that can mean. But I think to your point and what you just said is it allows people to be constantly questioning, to constantly be building their language and be applying it then, you know, when they do meet the world exactly where they are, to bring that into the workforce when they show up as their, you know, full selves or wherever, you know, wherever they are in life. I still have a book next to me that different book, obviously not yours, but from that I read, and it does, it sticks with you and informs how you, you know, move through the world in every sense. And I think, you know, your career is a testament to that. So I would like to shift into some of the professional stuff, you know, since that is again another core, you know, topic and theme that you explore and really, you know, examine in this. And my first question, you know, with that would be about visibility. And I know we've talked a lot about that already, just in the few questions that we've gone through. And this is a two-parter, and I can break it up again if it's easier. But what did visibility mean to you as an individual showing up, you know, at your first job? And then what did visibility mean, you know, as a queer woman creator at your job? And again, I can rephrase it again if it is cleaner that way. But
no, I got you. So my very first job in editorial was at a feminist journal that was published in the basement of an abortion clinic. And I was definitely the only lesbian working in the Women's Health Center. And I felt totally like an outsider all the time because I had been coming from college where I had like my crew. Yeah. And my job before that had been at Babeland. And it was like very jarring to suddenly be the only gay person, because I had been used to just being one of many. And I started to realize that, like, as the only gay person, I had a responsibility to make sure that my community was being represented in the content. And that is something that I took with me when I went to Refinery, where I was, again, the only lesbian, and realized that if I didn't do it, it wasn't going to get done. But there was also the issue of, like, being totally tokenized, and, like, people would come to me when they needed help, like finding sources, when they needed me to recommend like celebrities and influencers. Like, I was very much tasked with being the spokesperson for my entire community. Yeah. And Totally. I think that's something that happens to all kinds of marginalized people when they're the only one representing their community in a space. And I think it's such a misstep that straight white people make, which is assuming that just because someone is a member of that community, that A, they're an expert in that community, and B, that they want to be doing that.
Yeah.
So
like, I just want to write about, you know, this TV show, like, leave me alone.
Yeah.
You know, like, that is perfectly fine, you know?
Totally. And I felt really conflicted because I did want to be doing that. Like, yeah. I did want to be talking about queer people, but I also was resentful of it too, because I felt so alone. So one of the things that was most important to me when I became editor-in-chief and things were actually up to me was to hire a lot of queer people and like all different kinds of queer people and to empower them to tell the stories that they wanted to tell and to make sure that we had LGBTQ plus people in front of the camera and behind the camera so that it would never feel like superficial diversity, so that it was like a really mission-driven thing.
Yeah. And you basically just touched on it, but my next question was going to be how did all of that thinking, not just your identity, but all of the strappings that came with it, all of your reflections that you basically just shared, how did that manifest in your editorial decisions in a way that you feel was truly, truly distinct from anything that anybody else was doing or could even, some people probably couldn't fathom or wouldn't go there, you know?
So when I became EIC, which was in 2017, the first thing I did was a total rebrand. And I did an overhaul of the editorial strategy. And the reason I did it was because Nylon had been really good at speaking to the same person for 20 years. And that person was a skinny, white, rich, straight woman. And that's who was on their cover. That's who was working there mostly. I'm obviously with exceptions, but like the majority of people. And I just felt like this is not like the point of me doing this job. Mm-hmm. So before I created an editorial strategy, I created ethical pillars that I wanted us to do our content through. So those pillars were that I wanted us to be queer encompassing, meaning like anywhere you look on the site, a queer person can feel welcome. Mm-hmm. I wanted us to be actively anti-racist versus like diverse. Like I wanted us to be actively engaging with the issue of racism.
Using buzzwords.
Yeah. And I wanted us to be body positive and sex positive, and everything was filtered through that. And I think that really set us apart because we were never doing politics. Like we would do the occasional political story, but we didn't have a politics vertical. Okay. But by having like morals, we made everything from music, fashion, beauty, entertainment, lifestyle, we made everything inherently political. And I think all of that is because I'm a queer person. Yeah. Like, I think because I have experienced life differently, like as queer people do, I think I don't feel like I was held back by any sort of idea of what the magazine should or shouldn't be based on what other people were doing and historically what has been done.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I mean, it shows. I think everybody who's probably here knows that to a T. But I do, again, read about it because the way that you explain how it all came to life is incredible. And it does show that, you know, there are complications with doing that. It's not just like, I think a lot of times there's a misconception that you come in with this vision and it just happens, you know, effortlessly, which again, we'll talk about. But I do really encourage people to dig into like how it really comes to life and what it takes to make that happen. But I want to, as we kind of were talking earlier, you know, your book is getting a lot of attention. And I think one of the things that is right there in the title, you talk about hypocrisy. And we both worked at Refinery 29. And there are some parts of it, you know, that deal with specifically hypocrisy as it relates specifically to beauty. But I work there too, you know, and I can share in some of your experiences. Like, when Money Diaries was launching and they were talking about financial empowerment and everything like that, me and a lot of my colleagues were making, you know, $150 before taxes. So, you know, like it's not a huge number. And again, I was just bright eyed and ready to be in New York City and like
Right. Live
my best life. Like I would do anything, you know, I was thrilled, learning a lot, like getting to be on sets. But again, that's a point you're telling people to advocate for themselves and get what they deserve. And then also doing that. And it's not specific just to them, But I call this out because there are two things, again, hypocrisy that you talk about, but you also are getting a lot of buzz for being transparent about money. And I would love to talk about money because I think so many people are afraid to talk about money. And I would love to know why do you think that is the case? And what do we start to gain by having, you know, frank conversations about it?
Yeah, so I was so scared to talk about money, but I also felt like I could not write this book without talking about how much I was making at every single step because it informed the rest of my life.
Yeah.
So I was like, I need to either do this or not do this. And I also felt like how scary it was why I had to do it, because there's like, there's this culture of silence around how much people are making and specifically around how much women are making. And because of that, we have no idea how much we deserve. We have no idea how much we should ask for. Mm. And I just felt like the times that I felt the most empowered in my career were the times when people told me how much they were making. And I wanted to just like keep that tradition going and like really encourage people to be radically honest with their peers about their salaries, because like it's actually illegal to discourage people from disclosing salaries to each other, but HR departments won't tell you that because an HR department's job is to protect the company, not to protect you. So like you absolutely should talk to your peers about what you're making, figure out if you're being underpaid and ask for more, because the best way to ask for more money is to have like hard data that you deserve more. Like you can't just say, I want more money because I want more money, but you can say, I'm doing the same exact job as my male coworker and he's making 15K more than me. So I really think that like it all comes down to like paying women and women of color less than everyone else. And like the systems that were created to like keep it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and again, I think a lot of people are centering around, you know, especially that excerpt, because I think people want to know and they deserve to know. So I do think that hopefully, I think it'll be a rallying cry for a lot of folks to begin sharing more, you know.
I hope so. And like one of the things that I talk about in the book is that I felt really guilty complaining about my salary because I was making 100K as editor-in-chief. And like for a 27-year-old, that's an incredible amount of money. But for the editor-in-chief of an international publication, it's, you know, a third of what other people are making. So it was like I was being well paid for my age and my experience, but underpaid for the actual work I was doing. And I had no idea where that line was of what was appropriate to ask for given those circumstances. I just knew that it was unfair. And I knew that I was being used. Like I felt like a budget hire because I was. Like that is why, you know, corporations and companies put young people in leadership positions, like we're cheaper. And that feels really bad.
Yeah. And so perfect segue is like, what do you think, you know, is at the root of that? And how is it tied to, you know, media's ultimate function as a business, you know, that depends on making money to stay alive at the end of the day.
Right, exactly. I think it's so telling if you look at like the salaries of the generation of EICs that came before us and like all of the perks that they had, like, you know, like $800,000 salaries and a lifetime pension. Like that is not something that will ever exist in media again. And I think we are like entering media on the heels of like it falling apart because of decisions like that. And to your point, like media is a business and I think it's a poorly run business. And I think the model is really unsustainable. And I think part of the problem is that people want content to be free. And if you are creating something that people aren't paying for, it just becomes this total mess of where does the money come from? How do we keep the money coming from that? And like paying people well just becomes an afterthought because the point is to keep the business alive.
And to that point, I feel, you know, I'm an optimist at heart. Like I can't help it.
Love it.
I think that there has to be some kind of solution. Maybe it's not in the traditional systems we have, but perhaps it's, you know, people are making their own zines. There's, you know, tons of new ways for people to be empowered media creators on their own terms. But that being said, there still has to be systems in place that are inclusive and do allow people to claim their power within, you know, these methods of content creation. And from your vantage point, from your experience, what does that have to look like? What I know you talked about having ethical pillars. Would you maybe I think that that would be a great place to dig into those a little bit. What has to exist in order for media to thrive in whatever iteration it looks like?
It's such a hard question to answer because I really do feel like it's a business problem. And I feel like I'm with you. I feel optimistic about it because I feel like the good news is that people are reading more than they ever have before. And like, that's kind of why I don't feel tragic about the death of print. Like, I think it's a tragedy that people lost their jobs, but I don't think it's a tragedy that we've changed mediums. If anything, I just think it's like so great that people are just like hungry for more and more stories, and we have to give them more. Like, and for writers, I think that should be seen as something good. But I think the model of just having people churn out as much as they can churn out until they burn out and quit, like, that's not going to work. No. Yeah. So I think a subscription model is going to be what helps companies stay around longer. But I think when you have a product that people are subscribing to, you have to be able to feed them back content all the time. It can't just be like one thing once a month. So I just think there needs to be more balance.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think talking about balance is important, yes, in this respect, but it's also important when it comes to yourself. And I know this has already flown by, but I would be remiss if we didn't kind of talk about it. Because you are about work, about your identity, about life, you are just so, so transparent about the balance, your work-life balance, your emotional balance, your relationship, you know, your relationship with yourself. So I would love to talk about kind of just the balance of struggles and triumphs a little bit, you know, and what that looked like as it played out with everything else going on in your life. Because I think at a time where so many people are struggling off it silently now, because we're all in these little Zoom boxes, you know, what do you hope people can see and take away for themselves in this?
A few things. I think to the question about balance, the answer is that I had none, and that was the problem. Like, I threw myself into work, and when work fell apart and went away, I realized that I had made my identity something that didn't belong to me. And I just had this moment of like, I will never do this again. Like, I will never lose myself into a job. And I think it was important for me to have my journey progress the way it did, because I think at this point I'm so, so thankful for like my relationship and my friendship and the things that I do outside of work and my family. And you know, I'm glad that I had to be a mess in order to like get to a place of gratitude. But I hope that people read it and feel like they can be given permission to question the things that they're told to want. Because that was the biggest thing for me, is I just like, I never like set out to have a career in media. I just like went with the flow. Yeah. Like, really, it wasn't super intentional. So I wish that I had realized that I play an active role in my own life, and like there are always choices, and those choices lead to, you know, other lives that you live. So I hope that people reading it feel like, okay, like I don't have to just accept that these are good things. Like, I can question, even if it's like branded as good and packaged as good, I don't have to just be thankful and like happy to be here.
Yeah. I hope it's recording, so people will probably have access to that response later. I do want to make one more call to the Q&A before we, you know, get into our last few questions or anything like that. So if you have any pressing questions, get them in while you can. But my next question for you. I know I've been reading every single thing that comes out about this book. And one of the things I want to know, obviously I'm such a big fan of everything you're doing at Most. But what are the things, you know, that when you shut your laptop at the end of the day, like, what are you looking forward to about life now, you know, with the book out, you know, with a new kind of path forward, knowing everything you know about yourself now, what are you looking forward to? And like, what do you love about life now?
So many things. Oh my God. I mean, obviously life now is like uniquely hard because of what's happening in the world. But like, I like really like my job and it's really fun.
It's the best.
Yeah. Thank you. Like, I just kind of like laugh all day and that's really amazing. And like writing in a book instead of an article feels really good. Like, as someone who like only ever wanted to be a writer. And what I've been saying for a long time is like, I don't need it to be a New York Times bestseller. I just need it to do well enough that I can do a second book. Mm. And, like that's, I just want to be able to keep writing. And I feel like I have the emotional capacity to make time for it in a way that I didn't when I was in media, because like at the end of the day, I don't want to just like crawl into a hole and die. I want to like cook dinner with Wallace and like hang out and, you know, like be a real person instead of just like getting home and like immediately putting my pajamas on and like being in a coma.
I was wondering if we were going to get a Wallace guest appearance today. But next time. But I mean, that's amazing to hear. And then I know today, again, because I have not taken my eyes off my phone, I know that you went to Greenlight today to see your book in the flesh. After all this, after this conversation, your launch, like, how does it feel to like see it and hold it and touch it and know that it's out there?
It's so amazing and it's so scary. Because like the thing about a book like this is it really feels like me. So it's like I'm trying to separate, like, if someone doesn't like it, that doesn't mean that I am unlikable. That's like what I'm holding on to. But ultimately, it's been like such a positive experience. And I just like, I'm so grateful and surprised, honestly, by what the response has been.
Oh my gosh. Well, it has been amazing. I can't encourage the folks here enough to dive into it, read it. I think everyone will take away something from this that is really heartening and empowering, especially now. But I've talked enough. I think it's time to pass it along to some of the lovely questions we have. Well, I was going to say from the folks at home, like, I'm Alice on the L Word with her titular show, Alice. Everyone's at home, so I'm passing it to other folks at home. So let me just get in this Q&A. I feel like a grandfather with my corduroy. Like,
you're doing great.
All right, here I go. Okay, let's see. Oh, I see a familiar name. This comes from Mian. From Refinery 29. Amazing. Sorry, but we just all work together.
Yeah.
So. Hi, Gabrielle. You mentioned in one of your essays that there's incentive for media companies competing with algorithms and whatnot to sensationalize news, publish hot takes, and sometimes co-opt diversity, parentheses, ironically, still under the lens of Western beauty standards and advertisers.
Great point.
What do you think the future of media is, especially when so few people are willing to pay for journalism these days? And she would love to hear from my take, too.
I want to hear your take also. Because I just like agree with the points made in this question. And I think part of the problem is that the editorial staff still don't reflect the diversity that's being put on pages. And I think like it'll always be superficial if you're not putting money back into the communities that you're talking about. Like, you have to hire people and you have to pay them well and take care of them and make it so that they never want to quit, because like otherwise you're really just like using marginalized people's experiences to pretend that you're something that you're not. So I think like until the hiring problem is fixed, it's it's going to be really hard. But Wembley, what do you think?
What do I think? Gosh, again, I'm so bashful and I always just try to keep my head down and do a good job and do not try to make too much noise about like my whatever. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, it really cut to me. And I guess this is, again, perhaps a bias because I work specifically for the LGBTQ plus community and in sharing our stories and uplifting voices from our community, voices that probably wouldn't, you know, people wouldn't bat an eyelash if a pitch came across our inbox, you know, at other publications. So I really think that the future is community driven, whether it's through legacy media companies or not. Like if people don't, you know, start taking notice, they're going to start making outlets and organizations and networks for themselves. They're not going to wait for the invitation. And in some ways, I think it's better that way because everything will be able to be on their terms. So, you know, I'm paying really close attention to the ways in which people are creating consulting, you know, firms, creating, you know, their own beauty lines and things like that and turning those into, you know, media offshoots and outlets and commissioning their friends to take portraits and things like that for the product they want to make. I really do think that's the future. And I think legacy media has a responsibility to support that and to usher those folks in and pay them. But I don't think people have to stop and wait for permission or an invitation in the same way that they used to. And so again, from where I stand, technically, you know, a legacy company, I'm just trying to empower folks and get them, you know, get them as involved in what I'm doing to, again, continue to support their own creativity and innovation and collaborate in any way we can. And I hope that, I think more people are doing that. I really do. But I'm also excited to see things like most. Like, I think it's amazing. I think taking something that everybody thought was just, you know, streaming a few years ago, and now it's so all-encompassing and editorializing that and creating iterations off of, you know, a film. Like what does a film look like on social? I think that's amazing. So I think the future is truly just about thinking outside of the box of all the things that we've been taught we have to consume in a linear way, you know.
I think it's also, to your points, a question of like, do we as queer people prefer to have our own spaces, or do we prefer to have the spaces that already exist welcome us? And I feel like that's the choice we're so often given, when I think the answer for most of us is probably like, we want both. We want our own spaces and we want to come to your spaces because like that's what you want too. But I think
specifically for me, but then I also want to see them, you know, my stories right alongside and championed with the utmost resources, praise, acclaim.
Right. Yeah. And I think like that's really what we're up against at this point. And I remember someone at Nylon saying to me, like, she was like, I understand why a place like Nylon should be queer, but I don't understand why brands like Vanity Fair and like Vogue should have to talk about queer people. And I was like, I don't even understand what you don't understand, first of all, but like, that is so interesting that you don't get that, because I think there's this idea that like prestige media is for like straight people. And like this idea that having diversity somehow like brings down the brand and like makes it less elevated. Like we are up against so much in this.
We don't even realize, I think, especially when you log on Twitter and things like that, you think that everybody feels the same way as you and is going down the same, you know, mental wavelength as you. And then you realize it's so much bigger than just even, you know, this publication or that publication or who's here and who's there. It's you know, that's why I'm optimistic. I think there's a long way to go. And I do think that we're going to see some really amazing, innovative stuff in the coming years. But I don't want to talk too much again. These are plenty of questions here. This next one, switching gears a little bit, comes from Molly Walsh. And she says, or they say, excuse me, I don't want to, you know, gender anyone without knowing. I didn't really navigate my sexuality until my early 20s, and sometimes it feels like people I've known for years don't believe in my queerness. What advice do you both have for people that didn't come out in their teens?
So I will say, no matter what age you come out at, people will act like that. Like, when I came out at 19, there were people who didn't believe me and didn't take me seriously. Mm-hmm. So I think, like, you just have to go easy on yourself about it. And, like, don't let other people's interpretation of your experience inform your understanding of your own experience, because there are the things that you know about yourself to be true. And that's the most important thing. And I'm sorry to hear that. I hope that people don't make you feel like you're coming out late, because there's no such thing as coming out late. Like, everybody has their own process. And that's, like, one of the beautiful things about being part of this community.
And from me, I mean, I didn't come out to my family until, like, the weekend before the press release went out that I was becoming the head of them. So I don't think there's any such thing as late. And I think it's always up to your own terms and what you're comfortable with. And unfortunately, sometimes it doesn't work out that way. And I think, you know, I have such empathy for folks where that's the case. Again, like, I felt kind of rushed into it. Amazing reason to be, but, you know, I think it's a becoming at peace that sometimes it doesn't happen on the timeline you expect it to happen on. And I suppose in terms of advice, I think it's just, this is where I go inward. You know, I don't look here, look there, because all the time I wasn't out, I was, like, so upset that I wasn't quote unquote out, you know, and feeling like I was missing out on life. And I think the only one you owe anything in regards to your identity and understanding that is yourself, and processing that on your own wavelength. And does it in some ways, you know, hurt, like, that people don't believe that, whatever that means? Absolutely. But I think, you know, if you're sound in yourself, devouring queer media, you know, gravitating towards affirming books, affirming clothing, everything like that, I do think it makes that hurt a little bit easier. But obviously, that's not to diminish any kind of feelings that anyone has at all. But I found that that's what helped me, is just gravitating to things I could do on an individual, you know, self-affirming basis. Let's see, I'm back in this chat feature. Okay, so this comes from Nicole Ripka. I love how the most breathes lives into queer characters beyond the screen. Who have been some of your favorite queer characters from the year? So this is a bit of a wild card, but I think still a fun one.
Great question. I mean, I feel like anything that Sarah Paulson does is just, like, really perfect for what Most does. This is I'm sorry. I'm not good at, like, thinking of, like, pop culture things on the spot. I need to, like, Google. What do we talk about on the Most? I'm better at talking about what's coming up. That's okay. There's a movie coming out in February.
I know. Yes. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Called I Care a Lot. And it's, like, the best evil lesbian representation I've ever seen in my life. And it's, like, we never get to have, like, thought out bad queer characters who are in relationships and are whole people. We just get, like, caricatures of villains. So it's, like, really satisfying just to see, like, evil queerness.
Someone just be terrible. Yeah. Just absolutely terrible. Okay. And so I know we're, like, close to the end of time, so this will likely be the last question. And this one comes from another familiar name, Tyler McCall. What was the scariest or most intimidating prospect of putting out a book that is so vulnerably honest, and how were you able to tackle that?
Thank you for your question, Tyler. I think, honestly, the scariest part was people who know me well, but who might not know the full scope of the things I was talking about reading it. Like, scarier than strangers reading it was my family and friends, because I was so worried about, like, A, offending anyone, B, just, like, revealing all of my bullshit. And when you write a book, it's, like, it's on the page forever. And, like, It's hard for me to talk about painful things, even with my closest people, even with my therapist. Like, I always end up feeling like I'm better off just thinking about something on my own and processing it on my own. And it takes a lot for me to like get out of that mindset and talk to other people. So like putting it all down and then having to talk to other people about it was really terrifying. Like most people in my life didn't know that I was struggling with an eating disorder, and coming out as having had anorexia felt scarier than coming out as being gay did, because it's so stigmatized. And it felt like such a contradiction between like what my persona was and what my work had been. So I think all of that was the scariest parts.
Absolutely. I totally understand all of that. But I think in the end, what you have is such an amazing, beautiful, profound, powerful collection of essays, reflections, truths. And I can't thank you enough for sharing that with the world and with all of us. So with that, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm so happy that you did this. I feel like there are so few people who understand the very specific experience of being a queer woman and having an editor-in-chief title. So thank you so much for joining me to talk about it.
It's a small club, but a fun club. And everyone else, check out the book and find out what it's like amongst many, many, many other amazing things. But thank you so much. Take care.
I thank you both so much for that fantastic discussion. And thanks to all of you for joining us. If you missed any of tonight's event, or if you just want to watch it again, we will be posting the recording to our YouTube channel. So please look out for it there. And don't forget to buy your copy of Everybody Else is Perfect in-store or online at greenlightbookstore.com. Thanks so much for joining us, everyone. Have a great night.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Greenlight Bookstore podcast. We're grateful to our production partners at Libro FM for working with us to produce the quarantine season. Libro FM provides access to thousands of digital audiobooks through partnerships with independent bookstores nationwide. You can purchase Libro FM audiobooks at greenlightbookstore.com. You can subscribe to the Greenlight Bookstore podcast on iTunes, download it as a free audiobook from Libro FM, or stream it on greenlightbookstore.com/podcast. On the Greenlight website, you can also find links to purchase the books discussed in this episode and many more, as well as information about Greenlight's store locations and shopping hours. The best way to support your local independent bookstore and the literary communities we serve is as simple as buying a book.